All right, welcome back to another deep dive. We always like to find these fascinating cases, and today is no exception. We're looking at Hollywood, that whole world of movies and contracts, and oh boy, it gets complicated sometimes,
Oh
right?
yeah, it's a real jungle out there, and this case is really brings that home. Goodall v. Cecil B. DeMille Pictures. It's 1931, California. And it's I think a really good example for law students, especially, of how like artistic freedom bumps up against the hard realities of contracts and employment.
Yeah, because like everyone thinks of Hollywood, it's all glamour, but there's serious business going on behind the scenes, big, people's careers on the line. And this case, I think, shows that in a really stark way, an actress, Jetta Goodall, she gets fired from a major studio, and they claim she was difficult, but like m most things in law, it's not that simple, is it?
Nope. Not at all. I mean, what we're going to find out is what an employer can actually expect, from someone they hire. And when does that, cross the line into breach of contract territory, right? And especially with creative types like actors, is it just about showing up and saying your lines, or is there more to it?
Right. And that's what I think is so interesting here. Like, what are the rights of employees who are hired for their, their talent, their creativity, their intellectual contributions? Like, how do you measure that? How do you put that in a contract? And this case, Goodall gives us some answers, doesn't it?
Yeah, so to really grasp the significance of the case, we need to lay out the facts. Start at the beginning with the contract itself. So back in 1925, Jetta Goodall, she signs this one-year contract with DeMille Pictures. Standard stuff, right? But it had options for annual renewals, and this is important. Pay increases tied to those renewals.
Okay, so it's not just a, take it or leave it 1 year and you're done. There's a potential for this relationship to continue and for her to, earn more over time. And I guess that's going to become important later on, right?
Oh yeah, huge, huge point. But even more critical is how they describe her work in that initial contract. The language they used, it wasn't just about, showing up and acting, is very specific.
Yeah, the sources you shared, they highlight this part, don't they? It's not your average, job description.
Yeah, it said, let me see, I have it here. Special, unique, unusual, extraordinary, and intellectual. That's how they defined her services.
Wow, that's quite a list, right? And it really sets her apart. It's not just, any actress. They're saying she brings something very particular to the table. And that word intellectual really jumps out at me, especially thinking about, the legal arguments that come later.
Right. It shows that from the very beginning, they acknowledged that her contributions went beyond just, physical performance. There was an expectation of creative input, intellectual engagement.
Okay, so fast forward a bit. You said they had those renewal options, DeMille. They exercised those, right? So her employment continues.
Yeah, they renew it twice, actually. So she ends up working for them for almost 3 years under this contract. And then, bam, the firing comes in September 1927, right smack in the middle of what was effectively her 3rd year there.
Okay, so they've renewed her twice. They've presumably been okay with her work up to this point, and then suddenly she's out. What happened? What was DeMille's justification for letting her go?
Well, their official reason was that she was difficult. They said she argued with directors. She held up production. She wouldn't follow instructions. They basically painted this picture of her being this uncooperative diva causing problems on set.
But Goodall, she fights back, right? She doesn't just accept this. She says, "Hold on a second. My job isn't just to blindly follow orders. I was hired for my talent, my judgment, my artistic vision."
Exactly. She argued that any disagreements or suggestions she made were part of her fulfilling her role, trying to make the films better, contributing her expertise, not being insubordinate.
And the initial court decision, it actually sided with her, right?
Yeah, the trial court found in her favor and awarded her damages, a pretty substantial sum at the time, $34,531.23 to be exact.
Wow. Okay, so she wins round one, but of course this is Hollywood big studio, they appeal, right?
Oh yeah, they were going to let that stand. So the case goes up to the California Court of Appeal, and that's where it gets really interesting because now we get into the big legal questions.
Right. And this is where I think it becomes relevant for anyone studying law, beyond the specifics of this one case, we're looking at broader principles of contract law and employee rights. So what were the core issues the appellate court had to grapple with?
Well, there were two big ones. The first was DeMille actually justified in firing her? Legally speaking, did her conduct amount to a breach of contract? The second question was, if they weren't justified, were the damages awarded appropriate?
Okay, so let's unpack those one by one. Let's start with the termination. Was it justified? DeMille said she was difficult, she was disruptive, that this justified ending her contract. What did the court say to that?
Well, the appellate court They looked closely at the evidence DeMille presented, and they weren't impressed. Much of it was deemed inadmissible, like hearsay or, you know, just vague accusations. And there's this great example in the sources where they accused her of being late constantly. But the court found that those delays were often because of problems with the costume department, not her fault.
So right off the bat, their case starts to weaken.
Yeah.
Right? They're making these claims, but they don't have the strong evidence to back it up. But then there's a whole issue with the contract renewals, right? They kept re-upping her contract even after these supposed incidents of bad behavior.
Yeah, that was a big one. The court found that very problematic. Like, if she was so difficult, if she was really hindering production, why would they renew her contract twice and even give her raises? It just didn't add up.
It seems like a pretty strong contradiction, right? Their actions didn't really match their claims, and I imagine that played a big role in the court's thinking.
Oh, yeah. It undermined DeMille's whole argument that her conduct was this, you know, material breach of contract. But then there's that crucial phrase in the contract. Remember, special, unique, unusual, extraordinary, and intellectual services, that the court really zeroed in on that. Especially that word intellectual.
Right, because it speaks to her unique contributions as an artist, not just as someone, you know, punching the clock. So how did they interpret that?
Well, Justice Frick, he wrote the opinion for the court, and he had this amazing line. He said, and I'm quoting here, "What's insubordination for an extra might be praiseworthy cooperation from a star."
Wow, that's a great quote. It really gets to the heart of it, right?
Yeah.
There's a difference between someone who's just there to fill a role and someone who's brought in for their specific talent, their expertise, their creative judgment.
Yeah. Exactly. The court was basically saying, look, you hired this woman for her intellectual contributions. You can't then turn around and say she's breaching the contract by using her intellect, by offering suggestions, by pushing back on things she disagrees with.
So it's not just about obedience, it's about collaboration. And I guess that's particularly relevant in creative fields, right? You're not hiring a robot, you're hiring someone for their unique perspective.
Right. And the court made a clear distinction between what they called willful misconduct, which would be a legitimate breach of contract, and good faith efforts to contribute to the project. They said there was no evidence that Goodall was acting in bad faith, that she was intentionally trying to sabotage things.
So even if she disagreed with the director, even if she made suggestions that weren't always welcome, the court recognized that this could be part of her fulfilling her role as a creative professional, not grounds for firing her.
Exactly. So that's the termination issue. But then we have the damages question, right, DeMille? They argued that she didn't do enough to find other work after she was fired, that she should have mitigated her damages.
Yeah, that's a common argument, isn't it? The idea that you can't just sit back and collect damages. You have to make an effort to find new employment.
Right. But the court sided with Doodle on this, too. They said the burden of proof was on DeMille. It wasn't up to her to prove that there were no comparable jobs out there. DeMille had to show that suitable employment existed and that she unreasonably failed to pursue it, and they couldn't do that.
So they couldn't prove that she could have easily found another acting role just as good as the one she lost, and because of that, they remained liable for those damages.
Exactly, and this part of the ruling is really important because it sets a precedent for wrongful termination cases, especially in specialized fields like acting, where finding a comparable role is not always easy.
Right. It's not like you can just walk into any office and get a job with the same level of pay and prestige. And this makes it harder for employers to get out of paying damages by just saying, oh, you should have found another job. They have to actually demonstrate that those opportunities were really there.
Exactly. So thinking about the bigger picture now, what did Goodall v. DeMille really mean for the entertainment industry? What kind of precedent did it set?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is it recognized the special nature of contracts involving creative talent.
Right.
It said you can't treat these agreements like any other employment contract. There's a different dynamic at play.
Yeah, it highlighted that when you hire someone for their specific skills, their artistry, their intellectual property, you're implicitly agreeing to a certain level of collaboration. You're valuing their input, not just their obedience.
So it's not just a one-way street. The employer can't just dictate everything. The employee has a certain degree of autonomy, and I imagine that has implications not just for Hollywood, but for any industry where creative work is involved.
Absolutely. It's a really important principle. And for employers, it was a wake-up call. You know, they can't just throw around vague accusations of difficult behavior. They need to be specific. They need to address concerns directly. And they can't use those accusations later on as an excuse to fire someone after they've already renewed their contract multiple times.
Right. It puts more responsibility on the employer to be clear about their expectations, to document issues properly, and to act consistently. And the ruling on damages, that also sets a precedent. right? It raises the bar for employers trying to avoid paying damages.
Yeah, they can't just say, oh, the employee should have found another job. They have to prove it. They have to show that those comparable opportunities were really available. And that's especially important in specialized fields where those opportunities might be limited.
And there were some really memorable quotes from the court's opinion that you shared earlier. I'm thinking of the one about how even in menial jobs, employees can question orders.
Right. That one really emphasizes that it's a basic right to be able to raise concerns, to disagree in good faith, and it applies to everyone, not just high-level employees.
And then there's that other great quote, an artist isn't a puppet, which really captures the essence of this case, doesn't it?
Yeah, it shows that the court understood that artists, they need a certain degree of freedom.
Mm.
They're not just there to blindly follow orders. They need to be able to express their creativity, their vision.
So if we were to try and distill the key lessons from Goodall v. DeMille, what would those be? What should employers and employees, especially those in creative fields, take away from this case?
I think the first thing is the importance of clear contract language. You need to be very specific about the nature of the work, the expectations, the contributions. Everyone needs to be on the same page from the beginning.
And the second thing would be that actions speak louder than words, right? If an employer keeps renewing a contract, if they keep giving raises despite supposedly problematic behavior, that's going to weaken their case later on if they try to claim a breach of contract.
Exactly. Consistency is key. And the third takeaway, I think, is that the courts are going to look at the context, right? They're going to consider the nature of the work, the industry, the employee's role in all of that when deciding if there's been a legitimate breach of contract.
So it's not just about black and white rules. It's about understanding the nuances of each situation, and especially in creative fields, that context is so important.
Absolutely. And for you, as you continue your legal studies, I think this case is a great illustration of how those principles play out in the real world, how contract law and employment law intersect with the realities of creative work.
It definitely shows how a seemingly simple dispute, you know, actress gets fired, can open up all these complex legal questions. And for anyone entering the legal profession, understanding those nuances is crucial.
Absolutely. And it makes you think, you know, how would this case play out today in our current landscape with the rise of the gig economy and all these new ways of creating and distributing content? The technology has changed. But the fundamental questions about artistic freedom and contractual obligations, those are still very much alive.
Yeah, it's a whole new world out there. But the lessons from Goodall, they still resonate, don't they? It's a reminder that even in the most glamorous industries, contracts matter, context matters. And the courts are going to look at all of that when deciding these disputes.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder that for creative professionals, protecting their rights, understanding their contracts, that's essential.
It is. And it's fascinating to see how a case from almost 100 years ago can still offer so much insight for us today. So thanks for bringing this one to our attention. It's been a really thought-provoking deep dive.
My pleasure. Always happy to dig into these legal puzzles and see what we can uncover.
All right. And to all our listeners out there, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you on our next deep dive.
See you then.